You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 1982 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the third class in a series given by Brother Paul Zillmer on the subject, Problems of Suffering Job.
It's too bad, in a way, that the Lord doesn't speak out of whirlwinds anymore. We could all use a swift kick like that once in a while, I think. If we were in the position of one of the three men that we talked about yesterday, in our age now, that is in the position of holding on to a theory that just doesn't hold water, would we be shaken out of our complacency in time? We have to pray that the Lord will shake us the way He shook them that day by the providential means that He now employs, rather than the voice from the whirlwind, and through, of course, His Word also. But it's time now for us to get to Job. What about his spiritual state? Well, I think if we take Peter's spiritual ladder that he outlines in 2 Peter 1, we have to say that he was further up than his friends were. His friends showed little temperance and no endurance. They lost control in a mere verbal argument. They couldn't control themselves. What would they have done if they had been in Job's position, enduring what he was going through? Well, what Job did do in his position was to grow. And we have to remind ourselves once again that there was little or no written word at this time. He had very little to go on. All of what we have now had yet to be revealed, with the exception perhaps of whatever parts of Genesis were available to him. What had been revealed is not, we aren't told. But surely the light that Job had to see by was very dim. And if we can borrow the Apostle Paul's phrase, he was feeling after God to find him. And of one thing I think we can be absolutely certain, and that is that the hope of the resurrection had not yet been explicitly stated by God. When Jesus came to refute the Sadducees' teaching that there was no resurrection, he could summon nothing out of the law of Moses, which was the only part that the Sadducees would have accepted. But he could summon nothing out of the law of Moses that was an explicit statement that there would be a resurrection. He went to an implied argument. And in fact, we find that there is no explicit teaching of ultimate resurrection until the Psalms. Halfway between the creation and the present day, before the Lord explicitly stated that there was a hope of resurrection. And Job also, I think, is ignorant of the teaching that all fall short of the glory of God, which is also not stated until the Psalms. And involved with that is salvation by grace, the realization that no one is good enough to earn salvation. All fall short. Therefore, grace is essential for salvation. These things had not been explicitly stated by God to mankind yet. So in light of this, I consider Job's progress to be remarkable in the few clues that he had to work on. What we're going to do now is kind of outline his development, and I hope that we'll see some powerful lessons in watching him grow. Job's complaint begins in utter despair. We're aware that it took a while to get to this point. At the beginning, he blessed the Lord rather than cursing him the way his wife encouraged him to do. He was willing to accept evil at the hand of the Lord. His spiritual state at the beginning of his suffering was still sound. But then if that one clue that we mentioned yesterday is pointing us in the right direction, there came months of unrelenting suffering, pain. And as chapter 3 opens, Job is wishing that he had never lived. This is as low as a man can get, rock bottom. And through his first two speeches, that's exactly where he stays. And I think we can sum up that if we would read together. What I'd like you to do is open up and follow along with me. What we'll probably do is stay just right in Job here so you can follow along with me. And we'll sum up his early despair by reading a couple of verses from chapter 6, verses 8 and 9. Oh, that I might have my request, and that God would grant my desire, that it would please God to crush me, that he would let loose his hand and cut me off. We often think, or at least I'm under the impression that a lot of people think, that this is the tenor of all of Job's discourses. And it's true that his agony does not abate in the least through the course of this book. But that's what we might call the external man. The despair that is here is in the inner man, not the external man, the pain that he was going on. This despair is internal. And deep down in that internal man, he was too much of a man of faith to just keep going on like this, in this despair. And so even while his body continues to suffer, his mind starts working. And maybe it's the stimulus of having to answer his friend's accusations that gets him his mind going. But however it was that he's motivated, by the time his third speech comes around, Job isn't longing for death anymore, and you won't find him, after the second speech, desiring to die anymore. What he really wants is to come face to face with God and find out why all of this has come on him. He says, why can't I come face to face and you tell me why this is happening? Well, he realizes that he, a man, cannot stand in the presence of the Almighty. So he makes the first of many steps by desiring a mediator, or recognizing at least the need for a mediator. And if we turn to chapter 9 and start at verse 32, for he is not a man, as I am, that I might answer him, that we should come to trial together. He wants a hearing. There is no umpire between us who might lay his hand upon us both. You know, you've seen the umpire or the referee in a fight. That's what he wants. Somebody to lay his hand on both God and Job and say, okay, God, lay off of Job for a while, and you two now argue this out. And he says, then I would speak without fear of him, for I am not so in myself. Now, he thinks of this, the mediator that he wants as this somebody that could control both God and himself, so that he can present his case free of the suffering. And this, of course, is way off base as far as the kind of mediator that he really needed. But just recognizing that he needed someone between himself and God is a step forward. Well, he goes on in chapter 10 to reflect on the senselessness of God making man just to make him suffer. Chapter 10, verse 3. Does it seem good to thee to oppress, to despise the work of thy hands and favor the designs of the wicked? Verse 8. Thy hands fashioned and made me, and now thou dost turn about and destroy me. This doesn't make any sense. This is a positive step too. But he takes it the wrong way. Since he can't understand it, he comes to the conclusion that God may be irrational because he's doing this and it doesn't make any sense. But by the fourth speech, Job has come to an important conclusion. It's one of those things that's right in front of you all the time and you just can't see it. Until finally, chapter 12, verse 6, the tents of robbers are at peace, and those who provoke God are secure, who bring their God in their hand. Some wicked people prosper. Well, that's not too earth-shaking, is it? Perhaps not to us. But to him it was a revelation. The theory of exact retribution is false. The theology that he had understood up until this time was false, was not accurate and true to life. And this has just immense implications for him. One of them is that his friends are misrepresenting God, for one thing, and he's concerned about this, and in chapter 13 he warns them that they should stop doing this. They should stop misrepresenting God, because they are putting themselves in jeopardy by doing so. But more to the immediate point, this realization means that Job's suffering is not necessarily a punishment, an indictment of sin. And so God's doubts about Job's doubts, about God's wisdom are resolved. God is not irrational after all, as he says in verse 13, with God are wisdom and might. He has counsel and understanding. And so his earlier questioning God's wisdom has been resolved. Well, with a renewed confidence in God's justice, Job now resolves that he's going to take his life in his hands and he's going to present his case to the Almighty. chapter 13 and verse 13. Let me have silence, and I will speak, and let come on me what may. I will take my flesh in my teeth and put my life in my hand. Behold, he will slay me, I have no hope, yet I will defend my ways to his face. This will be my salvation, that a godless man shall not come before him. So he says, well, I'm going to take my life in my hands, and he may kill me, but a godless man just can't come before God, and so this will be my salvation. This is the first mention ever of salvation. That is, an ultimate vindication of some kind. His confidence in his own self-righteousness is still evident here. But this is a giant step, brothers and sisters, that he understood some kind of ultimate salvation, ultimate vindication. And he goes even further in verse 20. Only grant two things to me, then I will not hide myself from thy face. Withdraw thy hand from me, and let not dread of thee terrify me. Then call, and I will answer. Let me speak, or let me speak, and do thou reply me. How many are my iniquities and my sins? Make me know my transgression and my sin. Show me my sin, he says. He acknowledges now the possibility of a sin of which he is ignorant. This is a possibility that the friends never even considered. It never even entered their minds that there might have been something that he'd done wrong that he didn't know he'd done wrong. And from this revelation that there's possibility of doing something wrong without knowing it, he goes on further in chapter 14 in verse 4 to say, who can bring a clean thing out of an unclean? There is not one. Man is essentially unclean. This also is a revelation, a step, a growth in understanding on his part. And then comes the brightest flash of insight in this book, the hope of the resurrection, which he voices in chapter 14, beginning at verse 7. For there is hope for a tree, if it be cut down, that it will sprout again, that its shoots will not cease. Though its root grow old in the earth, and its stump die in the ground, yet at the scent of water it will bud and put forth branches like a young plant. But man dies and is laid low. Man breathes his last, and where is he? As waters fail from a lake, and river wastes away and dries up, so man lies down, rises not again. Till the heavens are no more, he will not awake, or be roused out of his sleep. Oh, that thou wouldst hide me in Sheol, that thou wouldst conceal me until thy wrath be past, that thou wouldst appoint me a set time, and remember me. If a man die, shall he live again? All the days of my service I would wait till my release would come. Thou wouldst call, and I would answer thee. Thou wouldst long for the work of thy hands. For thou wouldst number my steps. Thou wouldst not keep watch over my sin. He seems to say, oh, if it was only true, if it was only true that one could rise from death. See, he's seen the ultimate solution. He's seen that it's not in this life that the solution can be found to this dilemma that he's in. He says, oh, if it was only true that this life of suffering could end now and that there'd be something else later. And then he slips back, as we often do ourselves. At the end of chapter 14, he voices what he thinks is really the true situation, that man dies and that's the end. But just look how far he's come. Two speeches ago, he was at rock bottom, the absolute deepest level of despair it is possible for a man to get to. But he applies his mind to the few facts that he knows for certain. One, God is just, that he himself has lived a righteous life, and that he's suffering miserably. That's really all he has to go on. And from that little bit, with a mind of faith, he's able to see, first, the need for a mediator, second, there are reasons for suffering other than punishment. Third, there must be an ultimate vindication for the righteous. Four, man's reward is not in this life. Five, man is essentially unclean and ignorant. And six, the only real answer is resurrection from the dead. He has pulled all of that just out of applying a mind of faith to the few facts that he knew beyond doubt. Well, it's sad to see, after this growth, that Job's despair is renewed in his next discourse in chapter 16 and 17. I don't know, maybe we should lay some blame at Eliphaz's door, in the line that Brother David was talking about, providing a less than agreeable environment for his thinking. Eliphaz just fails to recognize any of this that Job has suddenly come to understand, and he just, well, in fact, begins rather testily to denounce and accuse Job, and Job's mood returns to that of despair. But he doesn't slip all the way back to the rock bottom that he was at before. In chapter 16, for instance, he calls God to witness to his integrity. He's putting his trust now in God's witnessing to him, and not in his own proclamation of his self-righteousness. And if we can apply an alternate translation to verse 21 of chapter 16, there's a further development, I think, in his thinking about man's need for an intercessor. This is just a suggestion as a possible alternative translation for verse 21. First we read verse 20. My friends scorn me, my eye pours out my tears to God. And then he says, oh, that one might plead for a man with God, as a son of man pleadeth for his neighbor. Now, if you're following along, that's different from the way your version reads, but that is an alternative way of translating those verses. That one might plead for a man with God. Now, this is a whole different concept than the umpire that he was asking for before. And something else sticks here, too. The conclusion that permanent death makes no sense. His earlier understanding just doesn't fit. And he gives expression to this in chapter 17, verses 13 through 16. If I look for Sheol as my house, if I spread my couch in darkness, if I say to the pit, you are my father, and to the worm, my mother or my sister, where then is my hope? Who will see my hope? Will it go down to the bars of Sheol? Shall we descend together into the dust? Dying forever just makes no sense, and he's come to realize this. Well, if we go to chapter 19 then, in Job's next discourse, we find that he's resumed his thinking process, and he's pulled himself out of the despair. We didn't read much of chapter 16 and 17, but it's pretty bleak. And in chapter 19, he longs for a written word to record what's going on here. And this in itself, I think, is an insight. His understanding of the need for future generations to have a record of the lives of God's people for their instruction, so that everybody won't have to go through this that he's going through, so that there can be a way of learning aside from having to repeat this suffering that he's going through. Through most of this chapter, 19, he catalogs his reproaches, first from God, then from everybody else he knew. But then he concludes at the end that the future is what is going to vindicate him. And we'll read from chapter 19, verses 25 through 27. For I know that my Redeemer lives, and at last he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been thus destroyed, then from my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see on my side, and my eyes shall behold and not another. My heart faints within me. This was a thought that was so great that it just took his breath away almost. Not only is there an expression here of faith in a just God who will vindicate the elect, but also a confidence in a future judgment. There appears here to be just a huge leap now to a conviction of a future resurrection. Before it was tentative. Now he's convinced. Now there is an alternate way of translating this verse, these verses, that would put it in a hypothetical sense, you know, if this was true and whatever. But I believe that this is what Job was actually conveying, that he has come to believe in a resurrection. Now just consider this, working on such few clues that he had to go by. Job has come to terms with his present situation. And he's come to a confidence in an ultimate vindication of God's people. And this is able to outweigh his bitterness over his present suffering. And I wonder how many of us, with our troubles much less than what Job was having to endure, with the revelation that we've received much more, we've got the whole thing, the complete plan, with all of this, and with our really relatively small troubles, are we able to come to the conclusions that he has? To come to a conviction of the ultimate vindication of God's people, regardless of what's going on now, regardless that I don't understand what's going on now, I'm certain that God will ultimately do justice. I wonder if we have such faith, if we can get such a grip on ourselves as he is able to do. Well, we can see that Job has reached a plateau when he gets to his next speech. He has to sit through a graphic and sometimes very crude listing of God's punishments from Zophar, and he seems to essentially ignore it, and then proceed to take what is a very dispassionate look, I think, at the world around him. With his eyes now open to the world as it really is, he only even refers to his suffering one time in this discourse, and that in passing. He's gotten beyond himself. He's not looking only at himself now. He's beginning to look around him and see things the way they really are. And with his enlarged perspective, he sees that, in fact, the wicked very often prosper. In fact, it's almost the rule that the wicked prosper. In fact, it seems like God almost seems to bless the people that are wicked. Contrary to what the friends are stating, and then he goes through and he quotes from each of his friends' arguments that they've advanced, and he refutes them each in turn. And his conclusion at the end of chapter 21, there is nothing left of your answers but falsehood. Well, Eliphaz interposes with just a diatribe against Job. But Job is unfazed now by these accusations, and in chapter 23, he again is longing to find God. Verse 3. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come even to his seat. I would lay my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I would learn what he would answer me and understand what he would say to me. Would he contend with me in the greatness of his power? No, he would give heed to me. There an upright man could reason with him, and I should be acquitted forever by my judge. He's now absolutely convinced of his ultimate vindication. He's no longer confused. But his concept of God is still just way too small. Job, ironically, is going to get the wish of these verses later on, when he will be face to face with the Almighty. The result is going to be a little different from what he anticipates in these verses. Job's going to come to understand that he is not capable of comprehending what God would reveal to him, even a small part of it. But verses 10 through 12 in the same chapter show a real quantum leap in Job's understanding of just what God is showing him. Chapter 23, verse 10. But he knows the way I take. When he has tried me, I shall come forth as gold. For any who are interested, this is the first use of that figure, and I believe that this is the basis of that figure of the tried gold that appears in the rest of Scripture. My foot has held fast to his steps, I have kept his way, and have not turned aside. He's come to understand why he's going through all of this. It's trial, not punishment. It's a refining process. And he realizes that he has passed the test. He has held fast to his integrity. He's not cursed God. But still, even so, he's perplexed, he is still a little despondent is also. And he doesn't claim to have understood it all by any means. Verse 16, God has made my heart faint. The Almighty has terrified me. For I am hemmed in by darkness, and thick darkness covers my face. That darkness was the greatness of his ignorance, which still remained. Even though he had come to know much more than he ever had before, there was still much that he didn't understand. And in chapter 24, Job goes on to bemoan the injustice of the wicked prospering at the expense of the poor, which is something he still doesn't understand. But this is man's injustice that he is crying out against, how unjust men are able to prosper and oppress the poor. And it even seems that God prolongs the days of the corrupt, and he ignores the pleas of the oppressed. A later preacher would say it this way: there is a vanity which takes place on earth, that there are righteous men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked, and there are wicked men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. I said that this also is vanity. That's from Ecclesiastes chapter 8. Just as an aside, there's a tendency, I think, to put the worst possible construction on some of Job's words, as I mentioned before, accusing him of what we think he implies. But before we're too harsh, as he's crying out against the Lord prolonging the days of the corrupt, we should consider, if we're going to condemn him, what we will do with the words of Asaph in Psalm 73, or the laments of Jeremiah, or the wisdom of the preacher in Ecclesiastes. All of them make very similar statements. Sometimes they even use very similar terms, making one wonder if they aren't in fact making direct reference to some of Job's statements. Especially this is true of Jeremiah. For any of you who care to, after you've finished reading Job this week, if you want to go read Lamentations, and if you do so with a pencil and paper handy, I would guess that you would come up with at least a dozen, and probably something more like 20 or 30 allusions to Job in Lamentations. And I'd like to do a little Levin-esque trick question and read you the third chapter of Lamentations and ask you which of the speeches of Job it comes from. It's indistinguishable from some of the things that Job says. But back to Job 24. Job concludes in this discourse, concludes his complaint about the state of the world by challenging anyone to prove him wrong. He says, "This is the way it looks to me. Prove me wrong if you can." And of course, nobody can. The world is just the same today. You look around yourself, and the world that Job describes in chapter 24 is the world we live in. Crime pays. It pays very well if you're good at it. It has always been so, and it always will be so, until justice and righteousness are established in the earth, in the kingdom of God. The poor of this world are just as cruelly oppressed as they've ever been. Job cries out against this state of affairs, and brothers and sisters, so should we. It was the outcry against Sodom that came to the Lord's ears that caused him to send his angels and destroy that wicked place. And I believe that if there is an outcry against this current evil world, the Lord will send his Son to do away with this world as well. Who is going to cry out against this state of affairs if it's not us, if it's not those of us who understand what it could be if it was only ruled by God's righteous king? Well, it's often noted that Elihu anticipates some of what the Lord is going to say about his creation, the wonders of how things are made. But Job beats Elihu to it in chapter 26. There's much awe in Job's very brief description here of parts of the creation, especially verses 6 through 14. It displays a much more balanced view of creation than Elihu is going to later reveal. And following this description of God's care for his creation and his wisdom in the creation comes that determination that we mentioned earlier from the beginning of chapter 27. We quoted a part of that yesterday, so we won't reread it. Never, as long as he lives, is he going to let go of righteousness. Is he going to turn away from striving for right and truth? I believe after this passage that ends in verse 6, Job's speech ends here. I was talking to Brother John Warner yesterday, and he's of the opinion that it may continue through verse 11, and that may be also. There's no third speech of Zophar in the text as it has come to us in the current time. There's a disruption of the poetic balance in this that is present everywhere else, and it makes this last speech of Job just incredibly long. Immensely longer than anything else in the book. These problems that we have disappear, especially also in the very definite similarities there are in the last part of chapter 27 to Zophar's earlier speeches. And the fact that Job would be refuting everything he just said if he really spoke this last part of chapter 27. These problems go away if we just think that perhaps an introduction to Zophar, that's all that it would be, just an introduction of Zophar, may have dropped from the text here. We can't prove that. It's just a hypothesis, but I think it makes this idea much more understandable. It also gives us in chapter 28, then, a more rounded understanding of Zophar. He's been a little bit of a cardboard character up till now, but this gives us an insight into a more whole man, and his conclusions from his discussion of God's wisdom at the end of chapter 28 fit very well with Zophar's earlier advice. So I'm going to go over that and on the hypothesis that this is Zophar speaking. And that leaves chapters 29 through 31 to be Job's final argument. His summation before the jury almost, and it has been suggested that the form he employs here is a legal form, a final declaration of one who is pleading not guilty at a trial. He's learned a lot. By the time he's come to this final point, we know that he's learned a lot, but his understanding is not yet as complete as it's going to be. We find here in his summation that his reasoning is very straightforward, very orderly, very complete, rational presentation of his case. And it has its desired effect. At the end of this, the friends have nothing left to say. What we're told is that they stopped because Job was righteous in his own eyes. I take this to mean that they were not actually convinced themselves, but rather they just gave up because they would eventually have to, that or abandon their own false premises. It would be good if we could read these three chapters, but because of the time factor, we're going to have to capsulize. Chapter 29 is an understandable longing for the way things used to be, when he was prosperous and happy and things were going well. But more importantly than that, it's more than that. We can't just look at it as that. It is also a reminder to his friends of what his life had really been like. Now remember, they were accusing him of all kinds of gross wickedness by the end of their speeches. And he reminds them of what his life had really been like in chapter 29. In verses 7 through 10, we read that he was a ruler, and not just that, but a respected one, one whom people really looked up to and respected. In verses 11 through 17, we read that he was a judge. It was he that was the judge for this area, who gave justice. And apparently he was a good one. It was recognized, in fact, by people that he was a good one, that he gave true justice. And in verse 14, we should note that his garments of office were a robe and a turban. Those are priestly garments. When we combine that with the fact that Job at the end tells the friends to bring an offering to Job that he would pray on their behalf, I think this is a clear indication that Job was a priest. Now Job has just gotten through the last speech swearing by God that he will not lie. And I think based on the man's integrity, we have to believe him. And so when he describes himself as a magnanimous leader, an honored and respected elder, I think we should believe him. But he's kind of blowing his own horn, isn't he? I mean, he's going through saying, I'm so great, boy, I was the greatest leader, I was the greatest judge, all of this. Can that be the statements of a righteous man? Well, I'm reminded very much of another son of God later who said, whatever anyone dares to boast of, I'm speaking as a fool. I also dare to boast of that. And later on he says, I've been a fool. You forced me to it, for I ought to have been commended by you. I think these words of Paul would express Job's feelings very well and the motivation for his going through this list of his accomplishments and his stature that should have been recognized by his friends. It's impossible in all of this to mistake the type of Christ in this 29th chapter. The priest, the judge, the ruler, all in one. Just read verses 15 through 17. I was eyes to the blind and feet to the lame, the healer. I was father to the poor, and I searched out the cause of him whom I did not know. I broke the fangs of the unrighteous and made him drop his prey from his teeth. This is the good shepherd that lays down his life for the sheep, that rescues the animal out of the very jaws of the predator. We read verses 21 and 22. Men listened to me and waited and kept silence for my counsel. After I spoke, they did not speak again. And my word dropped upon them. They waited for me as for the rain, and they opened their mouths as for the spring rain. He was the teacher of these people. Most of what Jesus did or will do is expressed in this chapter, in this description of what Job had been. So, how do you think Jesus read Job? He read, I am certain, from the Hebrew and not from that corrupted Septuagint text that we've referred to. If he followed the law, as I'm sure he did, he wrote for himself a copy of the Old Testament. What did he think of when he read about a man who suffered? A man who suffered while convinced of his own righteousness. Surely Jesus could see himself here, could learn about his own role, as he did always from reading the Old Testament scriptures. And if he learned from those great types that we're familiar with, David and Moses and the rest, as he surely did, he could only go so far with them, because they all suffered for sins that they had committed. But here in Job is a man who clings to his conviction of total uprightness, who in fact learned obedience through the things that he had suffered. Where did the writer to the Hebrews get that phrase? I was just talking to Brother David last evening, and his suggestion that the whole of Hebrews chapter 5 could be read as a commentary on Job and on the type of Job that is, or the type of Christ that is provided in Job. I have a hard time seeing this phrase, he learned obedience by the things he suffered. I have a hard time finding that in the Gospels. I've had trouble with that phrase for a long time. I don't see him learning obedience by things that he suffered in the Gospels. But I sure see it in Job. It's easy to see how Job learned, and especially learned obedience, through the things that he suffered. And then, by looking at Job and the type of Christ that's in Job, then I can see how it worked in the mind of Christ. And I believe Jesus saw himself here. I think there was at least three of Jesus' parables that can be traced to Job, and along with at least two or three other indirect references to this and his other teachings. If you just, we really don't have time, but I want to turn to Mark 10 just to demonstrate this. Verses 33 and 34, taking the 12 in 32, taking the 12 again, he began to tell them what was going to happen to him, saying, behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him to the Gentiles. And they will mock him and spit upon him and scourge him and kill him. And after 3 days he will rise. How did Jesus know that was going to happen? Well, I guess it might have been revealed to him in a direct revelation. But really, we only find an angel speaking to Jesus on two occasions, and I don't know how much was included in those, but I think Jesus learned mostly about himself from the Old Testament, not from an angel of the Lord being sent to tutor him. That tutoring was done in the Old Testament. That was what it was there for. I don't know of any place in the Old Testament that is quite so clear as Job 16 that Jesus might have learned that from. Job 16, verses 10 and 11. Men have gaped at me with their mouth. They have struck me insolently upon the cheek. They mass themselves together against me. God gives me up to the ungodly. This is the Gentiles. Remember that he said, they will deliver me to the Gentiles. God gives me up to the ungodly and casts me into the hands of the wicked. I may be making more out of this than you feel is appropriate, but I think this was the source of some of Jesus' understanding that he could so confidently say to the disciples exactly what was going to happen to him when he went into Jerusalem. And if you go back and read much of Job's outpourings as an expression of the mind of Christ, of a man who was truly blameless, Job was not, of course, but he thought he was, and he gave expression as one who is suffering while blameless, I think we can learn much about the mind of Christ, the same way as when you read the Psalms in this way. And I don't think there is anywhere else in the Old Testament that conveys with anywhere near the power of this type the shame of the cross. That's something that's made much of in the New Testament. The shame of the cross. The curses and the taunts that were hurled at both of these men for no other reason than that they were suffering. That people jump to the conclusion they must be getting their just deserts just because they seem to be accused by God because they're suffering. Cursed be everyone who hangs on a tree. Cursed be anyone who appears to have been abandoned by God, and they did earn God's curses. In chapter 30, going on in Job graphically recounts this shame, all of the shames that he has been subjected to, his reproaches. He was a leper. He was despised of men as only that disease can bring. He was dying. In fact, he was already lying on an ash heap. The symbolism of Jesus bearing that greatest of human diseases, mortality, of having all of our sin laid on him, of being consigned to the dust, given up for dead. It's all here in Job 30. I cry to thee and thou dost not answer me. Job said that. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Is what Jesus said. Well, for the benefit of his friends, Job in chapter 31 lays out his system for avoiding sin. And it's clearly a very carefully thought out code by which Job has lived a lifetime. We can easily see how the friends had nothing left to say after what he declares about his life. Job says he would readily accept the Lord's punishment if he's lusted or lied or coveted, if he's ignored his servants' complaints, or if he's refused to share what he has with people less fortunate, if he's trusted in his wealth, or if he's worshipped any other god, or even if he's been glad when his enemies were defeated. He would understand his suffering then. He even declares that he would comprehend it if he'd nurtured some secret internal sin that he never even let out of his heart. But if he just nurtured that in his heart, by all of this, I think he exhibits a far greater understanding than the three friends could even approach to. Where they were concerned just with gross wickedness, Job perceives that it's the heart that God wants. And it is the heart that he has freely offered to God all of his life. Well, it's apparent from chapter 31 that the motivation behind Job's religion was that same fear of retribution that the friends have been talking about. And what it all adds up to is salvation by works. And this, we know, is not the way to salvation, and Job is going to come to learn that. But this element aside, we have in chapter 31 a further unfolding of the type of Christ, the one who said, "Not my will, but thine be done." Regardless, I think, of Job's weaknesses and his ignorance, which we have mentioned, he remains one of the most powerful of the Old Testament types of the suffering servant. And even his mistakes, I think, are here for a reason. They were for Jesus to read as a warning for himself, to say, now here's some mistakes you might make when you come into this position of being called on to suffer on behalf of someone else, even though you're righteous. Be sure you don't fall into this trap. And I think Jesus learned that from reading Job. Well, we're at the end of Job's words, at the end of chapter 31. And immediately after it's clear that the friends have nothing left to say, Elihu begins to speak. Elihu was not previously a friend of Job. He probably didn't know him before. Perhaps he came from Mesopotamia with Bildad. Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar knew Job And they knew when he finished this defense of himself, they knew they had no grounds on which to accuse him. They were silenced. They couldn't substantiate these charges. Well, Elihu was under no such limitation of being familiar with Job himself, Job's actual behavior, and so he was free to attack on purely theoretical grounds, and this he proceeds to do with vigor. Now, I think we should make clear that Elihu does not prosecute his case on the same grounds as the other three. Chapter 34, verses 10 and 11. Therefore, this is Elihu speaking, "Therefore, hear me, you men of understanding. Far be it from God that he should do wickedness, and from the Almighty that he should do wrong. For according to the work of man, he will requite him, and according to his ways, he will make it befall him." Now, this is the theory of retribution, all right. The same theory that the friends were giving forth on. It's the exact same expression, the exact same doctrine that they were teaching. There's nothing here that's not true, of course, eventually. But Elihu does not have an ultimate thing in mind. What he has in mind, we see in verses 21 and on. "For the eyes of a man, for his eyes, that is God's eyes, are upon the ways of a man, and he sees all his steps. There's no gloom or deep darkness where evildoers may hide themselves. For he has not appointed a time for any man to go before God in judgment. He shatters the mighty without investigation and sets others in their place. Thus, knowing their works, he overturns them in the night, and they are crushed. He strikes them for their wickedness in the sight of men." Says he has not appointed a future judgment. He is not going to make an investigation. In the sight of men, under this sun, he will give punishment. So Elihu's case is not for an ultimate punishment of sinners. It's going to happen right now in this life. Now, so if you were reading along in the Authorized Version, you probably noticed a substantial difference in the reading of verse 23. But the consensus of most translations is what I just read. But there are, as I mentioned, there are substantial differences between Elihu and the other three, and we'll close with this for today. All of Elihu's thinking is on a higher plane than the other three who have accused Job. He perceives very clearly, as Job comes to, that it's the heart of man that God is interested in. He does not accuse Job of greed or abuse of power or the gross kinds of sins that the three friends do. Elihu indicts Job as being guilty of pride, and then going on from pride, guilty of scoffing, and going on from scoffing, guilty of rebellion. Those are the things that Elihu accuses Job of. These are internal matters, matters of the heart, not matters of gross wickedness that would be visible to men. Elihu's understanding of God is immensely greater than the three friends also. Elihu is continually emphasizing God's justice and his righteousness. He presents it as being of first importance to ascribe these things, justice and righteousness, to God. He says that you must ascribe these things to God. And of course, he's right. He claims God is the source of wisdom, not man's tradition or philosophy. And of course, he's right in that. God alone made and sustains the universe, and he reveals his character in the things that have been made, and that is right. God will not hear an insincere plea, nor will he regard one who is wise in his own conceit. And if you would care to look in chapter 33, I guess we're going to have to close for today, but in verses 29 and 30, he says that God chastens men in order to give them life. And this is just light years ahead of the three friends. Zophar depicting God as delighting and wreaking vengeance on sinful men. Elihu says the purpose of God is to draw men back from the pit so that they won't die. But we'll close with this thought. We saw a little while ago, he's also convinced that if the instruction doesn't work to bring back the man from the pit, then God is going to kill the sinner. And that is the fate that he wishes on Job. Chapter 34, verses 36 and 37. "Would that Job were tried to the end, because he answers like the wicked men. For he adds rebellion to his sin. He claps his hands among us and multiplies his words against God." It is Job's wish, or is Elihu's wish, that Job would be tried to the end and destroyed. And we'll go on with Elihu tomorrow.